number. This is Anne-Mette. Welcome again. I think it's 10 past 12 now, according to my watch. I want to suggest to the acting chair that we can start. Other members who are still coming, they will get us along the way. Thanks.
Good afternoon, honourable members, and team. But let me take this opportunity to welcome all of us, all of the members, into our portfolio meeting, where we meet the Department of Tourism, and they give us an assessment of the government technical advisory center, which is GTEC, on the implementation of projects. We know that resulting from our oversight, where we identified some gaps with projects, especially the SRI projects in infrastructure, where there were lots of glitches and issues, we recommended that the department had to come on board to ensure that they rehabilitate and give value for money for the projects that were being implemented, and where some of them had wrong specifications and others were not viable and so on. But before we head over, because we are meeting, I see new faces in the delegation of the department, I will take this opportunity to introduce ourselves so that we know, as we interact, we know who we're talking to. We will start with the honorable members, and then the department will follow, and then the supporting staff will then follow. I'm Lusizo Makubela Mashele. Currently, I'm acting as the chairperson of the portfolio committee. I'll hand over to you.
Thanks. Good afternoon. My name is Greg Crumbach. I represent the Democratic Alliance from KwaZulu-Natal.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Simpiwe Begwa, member of this committee. Thank you.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Patricia Adamson from the Northern Cape. I represent the ANC in this committee.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and members. My name is Manuku Masihel, member of this committee from Limpopo Province. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. We have a team here. Melanie, I don't think I need to introduce her. She's the Parliamentary Liaison Officer in the Minister's Office. Her name is Melanie Titus, just for the record. Shamila Chetia, you know her, she's the DDG responsible for destination development under which working for tourism, which is part of this particular discussion today. Lerato Matlakala is the chief director responsible for working for tourism. And Jonga, I also probably don't need to introduce him. Jonga Kosani, he's been in most of your site visits. Is a director within the Working for Program, Working for Tourism Program, and Bali Zama is also a director in that particular program as well. So Jonga is more on the side of planning and implementation, and Bali is more on the side of the technical systems that we use for BP. My name is Victor Tarange. I'm the accounting manager.
Okay,
thank you, Acting Chair. My name is Sarah Bolsina. I'm the Secretary of the Portfolio Committee on Tourism.
Afternoon, I'm Mr. Kuzwayo, the content advisor for the committee.
I'm Steve Gavinger, media officer for the committee.
I was outside. Good afternoon, members. I'm Pietro, the parliamentary liaison officer in the Office of the Director General to it.
Afternoon, everybody. Ismail Hussain, PMG.
Afternoon, everybody. I'm Nancy Peterson. I'm the secretary to the Works Committee.
Okay, although we didn't quite get what you said. Oh, researcher, okay, no, it's fine, you're welcome. DG, let me hand over to the secretary to give us apologies.
Thanks, Chair. We have two members who have officially tendered their apologies. It's Honorable Kheko. She will not be in the meeting today, and Honorable Forth as well. He will also not be able to be in the meeting for today. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks,
Secretary.
I would then hand over to you, DG Tarange, to take us through the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We will not waste time in the introduction, but perhaps it is important to highlight that the presentation we're going to be making today is a culmination of a number of processes that started a while back, which really were a product of what one would call combined assurance. So reports that would have come from Auditor General, reports that would have come from the internal auditors, reports that would have come from the forensic audit, and feedback on matters that would have come from site visits by honorable members to some of the projects and discussions that we have had here in Parliament as well. We realized at some stage that we were basically putting good money after bad, if one could put it like that. And we had to stop some of the projects. We have already been here and we have given a comprehensive report on what came out of the forensic audit. But today then relates to what then do we do as the department. We acquired the services of GTEC, which were twofold, short-term and also a long-term assignment. The short-term assignment was to conduct both economic as well as technical assessment of this project with a view to get an indication as to whether there are areas where we perhaps need to cut losses and move on, or there are things that we've got to do but perhaps differently. So the report would actually entertain those two issues. The long-term assignment relates to the review of our processes, systems, and so on in terms of how do we strengthen this going forward. So that assignment, they're still also doing that, whilst we are also introducing some improvements in our systems as well. Then What we will take you through would be, out of the 32 projects that were assessed, we'll take you through 31 as opposed to 32. The reason for that is because the 32nd is a project that is funded through EU funding. It uses a whole different methodology and so on, and has got other processes that we've got to report on and so on, which is implemented in partnership with CERNPAX. It's on track, but the planning phase of that had to take quite a lot of time because of the nature of the project. You probably have heard about this dinosaur project in the Free State, in the Golden Gate. So the nature of the area requires a whole lot of other processes that we've got to go through. So we'll not go into that one. It's actually in safe hands, if I could put it that way. But we will take you through the remainder of the project. What I should also mention is that it's not everything that we agree with GTEC on. There are areas where they would make certain suggestions they would make suggestions based on certain assumptions about what they think should be our mandate as opposed to what is our mandate. And sometimes the definition of who they deem to be a tourist into a particular area or not. And some of those examples, there's one specific example where there's a specific road that goes into a site which is used a lot by tourists who are coming for, I would call it spiritual reasons. They are coming from all sorts of countries, Botswana, Lesotho, and so on, the Free State. But they don't deem these people as tourists. But what we're saying is that the people are actually coming to that particular site. Even if the site itself is not a commercial activity, these people will have to find a place to sleep. They will have to find a place to buy food and so on and so forth. And this would actually add to the economy. So there are those types of categories. The DDG is going to take us through the report in terms of the details with regards to the projects that we're reporting on today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to try not to dwell on each slide, but to go through them in terms of the principles and to focus a little bit more then on the recommendations that are coming out of the broader assignment, if that's acceptable. The first few slides really relate to acronyms. The introduction's already been covered by the DG. So I'm going to really start on slide 6 of the presentation itself. As we've said, there were 32 projects that were assessed. They fell into 4 different categories. The first category was projects that were in construction, but that had stalled due to implementation of funding challenges. There were projects then in a separate category that were actually requesting additional funding for new scope of work or completion of the current scope of work. The third category is projects at the planning stage, and no construction had yet commenced on those projects. And the last category is projects at the pre-feasibility stage. We do have a summary slide later on that says which projects were at what stage. And in the heading of each of the slides, it also says what stage projects were. By far and large, the projects we covered in the assessment and in our project portfolio are accommodation establishments. And they covered 12 of the 32 of these projects. And then there was another type of project that's related to visitor centers, which covered 10 of the 32 projects. The remaining 4 projects that were evaluated relate to road infrastructure, pedestrian or other support infrastructure, and then, of course, a training center. The DG has already spoken to the dinosaur project. Of the 32 projects, 17 actually were visited on site. The other projects were assessed through project documentation. And the reason and logic for this is that some of them that were at planning or were additional requests for funding didn't necessarily need a site visit. And through that process, what was looked at was really the the feasibility of these projects as well as a technical assessment of them. So slide 9 basically contains a summary of the various types of projects. 10 were stalled, 5 were requests for additional funds, 14 were at the planning stage, and 2 were at the pre-feasibility stage. I will now go to slide 11, which basically talks to the projects themselves. And I think that the way I will deal with them, if it's acceptable, Chair, is that where we have agreement with GTEC, I won't actually belabor the point. I will just say what the recommendation is and that we were in agreement with it. But on the 8 projects where we have a difference of opinion with them, I will explain the reason for our recommendation, which is different. So Inyandeni in the Eastern Cape was stalled, and essentially what we have decided to do with this project and agreeing with GTEC is to complete the outstanding feasibility assessment element in order for us to proceed. The next project, which is Western Timberland, is also the same recommendation to complete the outstanding elements and based on the feasibility study and then proceed with the project. It was also stalled at some stage. Tatwa is actually commissioned a study for alternate site use. So we're in agreement with the recommendations made that we in fact don't proceed as it was initially conceptualized, but that we actually look at alternate site use for the site.
I'm really sorry to interrupt the presentation, but I'm not understanding how we're doing this. I mean, I understand why we're here today, but there are projects that we're now going through that have been stalled, and we're racing through them. Is it the intention to go back after the completed presentation and try and find out what went wrong with each one? Because, I mean, I can read, so can everybody else. We're not really getting any extra information, and the question why is far more important than what in this particular case. What do you envisage the format of this particular interaction to be? I'm really sorry to hold up the scene, though. I just don't get the sense that we're doing this in a useful way.
Sure.
Honorable Chairperson, I think we did come here with a forensic report. And we went through this project before GTEC. Now, what we asked GTEC to do was to guess whether there is an economic case for a particular project. Secondly, whether this project should proceed or not proceed. In some instances, including the physical infrastructure, whether it should be demolished, whether it would actually fit the purpose that we are dealing with and so on. So if we were to go back to the original diagnosis, that's a different presentation. What we were doing, we were saying, all these projects, and this is why I started by saying that you would have had projects where you get a request for funding today. In 6 months' time, you get a request for additional funding. You go on site and you can see that there are problems here. And that's why we actually got a forensic on it. That actually told us what the problems are. We actually gave a report here about who are we taking to the police. We gave a report about the status of the different cases and so on. There were actual cases where there were problems with the implementers of the project, and so on and so forth. So those we had actually gone through in quite a thorough detail. So what we were coming here to do today was to be able to say, honorable members, we've been through this particular process now. GTEC is saying the infrastructure you put in this particular site, you can proceed with it, you can try and complete it, it will still work, there's an economic case for it. This infrastructure you put here is good infrastructure, but there's no economic case for it, get an alternative user for this particular So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to bring today. But that other aspect, there is even a presentation, I think the secretary could go into the record. There's a presentation we brought in terms of the problems with the various projects that were actually audited.
So basically, of the 32 projects that we are, that are in question, you were saying to us, DDG, how many you got, how many that are okay, you agree with GTEC,
mm-hmm.
And then you were saying there's also a...
So, Honourable Chair, what I was saying was that of the 32, GTEC has made recommendations for each of them.
Mm-hmm.
23 of those recommendations we support and agree with. There are 8 recommendations where we have a difference of opinion, and that difference of opinion, as the DG has indicated earlier, is related to their understanding of our mandate versus our understanding of our mandate. So there are only 8 basically where we have disagreed with their opinion, and we are essentially taking a different route with those projects.
Okay, honourable members, what I understand the task at hand today is was to get some assessment and some feedback on where the GTEC process is. Even if where the project is stalled because maybe there isn't funding, you are waiting for the next financial year, it's okay. It's for us to understand the process of GTEC, whether it's moving in the direction which we or the department would have wanted it to move towards. Unless there's anything further to add, Honourable Cromwell. But my understanding was we wanted to get an assessment, some feedback on how the projects are, whether GTEC has come in and is assisting the process moving forward, because we understand we also went to some of the sites that are here, and some of them there wasn't any activity, but some of the projects were complete, some of the projects were not complete, so an intervention was needed so that we move on. Honorable Masihela.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think what you are saying is quite correct. Indeed, we did get a report on this different project and the problems that they encountered, and also some of them were the people involved, some of them it was a police case and so on. That report we did get. But now, today it is for us to know what is the outcome of the GTEC after their intervention. Are they saying we should go on with this project according to them, or are they saying discontinue it, or what are they saying? That is where we are for today. And they are saying they are also going to tell us where they differ with the GTEC, and if they differ with them, what is their own opinion? How do we move forward in those particular projects? Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We are now on slide 14, which is the Rock Arts Project. Essentially, the GTEC recommendation says that we shouldn't invest any further money in this project because it can't be justified in terms of the net income it will receive beyond a completion. And they have suggested alternate site use be considered for the property. We support that, and we're working with the local authority to assess what alternate site use could be. With regards to the next project, which is the Mthonzi Lodge, again, we are in agreement with the GTEC assessment, and what we are doing there is finalizing the operational model before proceeding with the project itself, and this is really looking at the long-term sustainability of the project. The next project is the Kiwani Campsite Project. This project was in our books at the planning stage. GTEC recommended that we didn't proceed with the project. This is one of the 8 that we have a difference of opinion on. And the reason for the difference of opinion is that the recommendation made by GTEC has essentially been overtaken by Venn, because the local municipality has in fact completed the structural assessment on the project, and they have commenced with completion of that project. So we have communicated the findings of the report with the municipality, and we are have transferred full responsibility therefore for this project to that municipality. The next project is the Tenderhead Lodge and Mountain Reserve. Essentially, what happened on the site was that there was a fire, and the fire damaged the facility that was actually constructed. GTEC did a structural assessment of the actual property and advised us to demolish the building, given that it was unsafe. We are agreeing with that recommendation and are in the process of completing the demolition of that building. With Imzansane Lodge, again, we are also in agreement with the recommendations made by GTEC, and they've essentially said to us that the capital cost for completing the building is actually quite high and poses risk in terms of long-term sustainability. They've advised that we don't proceed with the project, and we're in agreement with that recommendation.
Shamla, I think what you may want to also highlight is, even if, though it's written, this was planning stage, so there is not, there's no money put in any capital work that
done yet
for this site.
Sure.
Yeah,
and the good part of this one, we also went to the project and
The next one is the Frederfort Dome, and of course this is the World Heritage Site, which is in the Free State. GTEC has basically said to us that we should proceed with the project in parallel with completing the required elements of the feasibility study and the operational model, and we are in agreement with that statement. Similarly, we are in agreement with the Baralong Busuleka Village project. This was one of the projects that was stalled. GTEC has recommended that we should actually finalize the outstanding elements of the feasibility assessment and then proceed with the project. The next one is the road, which the DG spoke to. This is basically the development of a road that leads to the Wetsi Cave site, which is a site of spiritual significance. GTEC essentially said to us that their recommendation was that we shouldn't proceed with this, because their sense was that the construction of a road was not really within a tourism mandate. This is the project that we're disagreeing with them on, because actually the completion of that road really provides access to what is a very well-used site and well-visited. And so we will proceed with this project on the basis that we want to actually complete the provision of access to the site, which was incomplete. There are basically 700 meters of the road that needs to be completed, and 1.1 kilometers of it has already been completed. So this is one where we do disagree with them with regards to this. The next one, which is the Empereni Hospitality Training Center, is also a project where we are in disagreement with the findings. They've recommended that we proceed with it subject to findings of a feasibility study. They have in fact given us the costing for what this would cost. So initially this project was estimated at 18.8 million rand. The current estimates to complete the project are actually at 45.5 million. This project is also at the planning stage. So apart from planning, we actually haven't done any construction on site. We have determined that in light of our fiscal constraints, we are not in the position to actually proceed with this project at a cost of 45.5 million. So we are disagreeing with the finding, and we will not proceed with this particular project.
Just to add to what Shamila is saying, that's 45.5 million in last year's budget. And if we were going to start any work, the likelihood that work would probably be in 2019, which is not going to be anything less than 6 months.
Thank you, DG. The next project is the Maseleoniane Information Center. This project has in fact been completed and it's already been handed over to the municipality. So there is in fact no further action required, and GTEC essentially said there's no further action required on this particular project. With regards to the Platfontein Lodge project in the Northern Cape, GTEC has recommended that we address the operational sustainability issues on the project and that we actually proceed with the project in parallel with doing this. And we are, in fact, in agreement with that recommendation and we will move forward with this project. The next one is the Tummies Bag Tourism Development, which is also in the Northern Cape. This project was at some stage stalled and it's the recommendation was essentially that we proceed with the project, but that we exclude the visitor information center because the sense was that this was not the correct location for that. So we will actually address matters of the sustainable operational model and then proceed with completing the project. The Ngobe project was one that had requested additional funds to complete additional scope of work related on the project. GTEC supports us proceeding in parallel with addressing the sustainability model, and the estimated cost on this is 17.7 million. We are in agreement with that recommendation. The Papidi Waterfalls project similarly, which is in Limpopo, they have recommended that we proceed and we have no difference of opinion on this. So we will proceed with the project in parallel with addressing the conditions of the feasibility study. The 24 Rivers project, which was at a planning stage, essentially GTEC is recommending that the current conceptualization of the project, we shouldn't really proceed with it because they have issues around the long-term financial viability of it. They've recommended that we actually look at alternate site use for this property, and that is what we're commissioning at the moment, an alternate site use study in order for us to determine how we proceed. The next one is the Sekukuni project. We are in disagreement with their recommendation because essentially they're saying don't proceed with the project, review it for alternate site use. But on the site at the moment, there are in fact properties, buildings that are incomplete. So what we would like to do with this is to actually complete the existing buildings because otherwise they will fall into disrepair and then negotiate alternate site use with the local authority. So in completing the buildings, we will have discussions with the local authority so that when they are complete, they actually meet the purpose of the alternate site use. Tisane actually requested additional money, funding, and GTEC recommended that we proceed at a cost, estimated cost of 17.9 million, and that before proceeding, we should really finalize the outstanding elements of the feasibility study. We will, in fact, continue as recommended on this particular project. Batsonga, which is also in Limpopo, was at some point stalled. GTEC has said to us that we should finalize the outstanding elements of the feasibility study before we proceed, and we are in agreement with their recommendation. The Oaks project, which was also at a planning stage, has the same recommendation that we essentially proceed in parallel with addressing the findings of the feasibility study at an estimated cost of 15.5 million, and we accept that recommendation. Similarly for Lilani Hot Springs, which is in KZN, which was at a request for additional funds, we are proceeding in parallel with addressing the sustainability model. MUSIPAN, I think that the recommendation is around the finalization of the operational model again, and we are in agreement with this specific recommendation. The next project is Lot La Moraine Dam, which is in the northwest. This is also at the planning stage. What GTEC has said to us is that the current designs or the current concept that is proposed is in fact too costly and poses risks for us from an operational perspective. They say to us that we need to reconceptualize this project before we proceed, and we are working with the province to actually work on reconceptualization in order to determine how we proceed with the project. The Manyane Lodge in the northwest is a request for additional funding. GTEC has recommended that we proceed at an estimated cost of $15.7 million, and at the same time that we actually address the sustainability model, and we are in agreement with this particular recommendation. Lehurutse and the next project, which is Lobatlane, are both at the planning stage. GTEC has recommended that we should proceed with these projects subject to feasibility study. However, in discussions with the province, we understand that the province has not made any commitments to this project, and nor has the department. And so we are taking discussion with the province on both Lehurutse and Lobatlane, which is the next one, in order to determine whether we will proceed with them into the next stage or not. The next slide, I'm on slide 39 now, is the Botlavela Cultural Village, which is in Mpumalanga. On this particular project, we do disagree with the recommendation. So the recommendation from GTEC was that we do not proceed with the project and review it for alternate site use. I think that the department had previously decided to complete the buildings and appointed a service provider before GTEC had actually come into space. The service provider's report basically recommended that no further work should be completed on this specific project. Because there are a number of governance-related issues, and there are also issues related to long-term viability of the project. GTEC's recommendations was made without the knowledge of this report in mind. So the department in this instance is not going to proceed with this project at all. And what they were suggesting was that we reconceptualize. So we're not proceeding in any shape or form, even in a reconceptualized way. The Mnisi project, which is in Mpumalanga, was at a planning stage, and what was recommended by GTEC was that we reconceptualize the project, and that is exactly what we are going to do. The Cape Agulhas project, which is in the Western Cape, was at a planning stage. This was the one project that did receive unconditional proceed by GTEC, and in fact we have proceeded with the project, and I think that phase is nearing completion. With regards to what the outcomes then of these 32 reports have said to us about the long-term model for our working model. So essentially I've gone through each of these individual assessments, and what it really says to us is what I think we have known for a little while is that we actually need a revised project management model. The way that we run these projects needs to operate in a fundamentally different way. They're saying to us that as part of it, and I think we have shared these challenges in the past, that many of the projects looked at a sustainability model quite late in the development. So what the recommendation is saying to us is that we need to look at these sustainability issues upfront at a pre-feasibility stage in order to avoid investment and then unsustainable projects down the line. The next thing that it says to us is that in looking at the feasibility and the sustainability model, we need to bring on board right at the beginning all of our partners from the private sector, from the community, and also from development funding institutions. So that responsibility for taking over the operations at the end, the maintenance of the projects, are agreed to with a variety of stakeholders up front. And then the next thing that they're recommending to us is that we actually work with a design by client. What that model essentially says is that you have a professional services team of architects, quantity surveyors, engineers that are in fact part of the client's team. They advise with regards to the project design, to the costing in terms of construction, and they in fact assist to manage the implement on site. So this will take care of some of the challenges that we have had with regards to infrastructure delivery that may not necessarily have been the best way to deliver it, and also to deal with maintenance down the line. I'm not going to go through this model, but this is a very generic model around project management and the various stages of project management. It's essentially looking at stages that are aligned to what you deliver at the end of each stage, and GTEC has in fact developed all of the templates and all of the documents that need to be provided at the end of each stage for this. So we're looking at how we infuse the current well-developed and practiced project management methodology that GTEC has. The next thing, of course, that GTEC is recommending, specific to infrastructure projects, is that we strengthen our collaboration with tourism infrastructure experts and facilities investors, and that we also work in tandem with financing entities upfront in terms of our projects. They have also recommended that in doing that, work with funding entities, etc., that we actually work with Treasury, we work with the likes of the IDC and the NEF and the Development Bank of Southern Africa, and that we actually look at issuing a call of proposals for wider investment in these specific projects to deal with long-term sustainability. I think what is also coming to being, I'm on slide 47, since July 2016, is the standard for infrastructure procurement and delivery management, which we are obligated by law to actually implement for any infrastructure projects. I won't go through this in detail, but what is very nice about the standard is that it also has stages. Essentially, your project initiation looks at all of the issues of long-term sustainability right up front. And if you don't get a green light on your business case, then the project doesn't proceed. So each of these stages basically progressively assist to deal with some of the challenges that we've had around implementation of infrastructure. It is, of course, the Treasury standard, and so this is what we are in the process of implementing within the department. So the very last slide, then, relates to what we need to do and the estimated time frames. There are a number of projects, as I've gone through, that require detailed feasibility studies, require finalization of the operational models, or reconceptualization of alternate site use. We are essentially dealing with each of these projects on an individual basis, and we would have concluded our process by the 30th of June this year. The next set is really in line with the SIPTIM stages, the infrastructure standard, to set up a panel of built environment professional service providers that can help us to implement the infrastructure projects according to the standard itself. And that process will also be concluded by the 30th of June this year. The GTEC long-term assignment basically ends in October. By that point, we will have revised our processes, our guidelines, and our alignment to the standard for infrastructure delivery and management and procurement. And then the completion of the stalled projects based on the outcome of the findings, those that we have agreed that we are basically going to now implement will be concluded by the 31st of March 2019. Those projects have been, of course, factored into our budgeting and planning processes. So we are quite sure that we have the funding where we have made the decisions to proceed, to proceed. I think, Honourable Chair, that concludes the presentation itself.
Honourable Chairperson, the one thing that I want to just place on record is that you can see that our plan is quite ambitious. We are going to throw everything at it to try and see if we get it within the period. But suffice to say that between the appointment of this panel and the actual conclusion of the work, there's still going to be some work to be done in between. And so if it doesn't necessarily become much, but at least by June next year we are done with those projects, it will be good. What we are faced with also is the application of the EPWP methodology on infrastructure projects. By and large, was also a challenge in terms of being able to complete some of these projects timeously. So that tension would still somewhat exist, and what we're trying to do is to find a way of having a combination of resources as opposed to solely using the EPWP methodology. So we've got a little bit of resources for destination development, which we think as we do that hybridization, then it might actually assist for us to be able to get some of these things sped up. The issue will be speed, because the longer we delay in terms of completion, the costs are going to further escalate again. So we'll have to find to make sure that there's a little bit of a combination of resources across the different projects for us to be able to complete. What we are happy about overall, very happy about, is that there are clear decisions about projects that we will not be proceeding with. So that is something that we are able to put aside completely. Then there are decisions about projects. Well, there are projects that are already completed as such, which also we are happy about that, because it takes away the load of the projects that we're actually supposed to be chasing. Once we've got the feasibility outcome, my take is that you will have to come back so that we can give you an update on which projects of the ones that we said feasibility then continue or not continue, which of those projects would then finally continue, because that would actually be the final batch. And that's why we're trying to get this feasibility as quickly out of the way as we possibly can. And once we have got that, then we'll be able to say these are the 10 or the 11 or 12 projects that we're actually going to be completing with greater certainty. There's a few, obviously, that they have already indicated we should proceed. So those ones we are already proceeding. But there are those that they have actually said, try and look for other ways in terms of those alternate use, those engagements we are doing parallel. So it's going to be a very busy period for them. They have another team that is not necessarily here that focuses on these issues such as feasibility and so on. What do you call that team? The sub team in the investment team, the Kenny and them. It's investment and what? Yes. And then they've got another team that deals with product development. So it's not just going to be these guys that are here. It's the broader team that's going to be focusing on these things and making sure that we try and succeed. Thank you, John.
Honorable members,
thank you, Honourable Combo, followed by Honourable Adam, and Honourable Masihela, and that's it.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just ask up front, what part of the tourism budget do these projects come out of? There's obviously a particular environment or particular budget section that paid out of, obviously not the coming out of the biggest part of the budget, which is the transfer to SAT. So it will be one of the others. Can you just remind us what that is? And then, bearing in mind you set yourself a target by essentially this time next year to complete all these outstanding projects, do you have an idea what the total cost will be? I mean, one could actually ascertain it from the presentation by simply adding up, but some of them require further study to be done before a final decision is taken, in conjunction with a reconceptualization, so it might not be the right figure. So those are two fairly easy questions. What worries me a lot, though, is this presentation, and I'm starting to recall what we were told when we got the forensic report. So I'm really confining my comments to the documents we have in front of me, or front of us. But there's several aspects that really make me feel very uncomfortable. I mean, there are a number of projects here, and it might be helpful just to add up and see how many, which started a long time ago. I mean, very long time ago, and they've been going on year after year after year, and then they've stalled. And I'm not understanding how a project can actually stall. If it's properly planned and the budget is correct and we sign contracts through a proper tender process, one shouldn't run out of money, and one shouldn't need, in some of these cases, as much money to complete as what's already been spent. I mean, it's just, the warning lights are flashing bright red on many of these projects that have been presented today. So my first concern is the fact that some of these things go back to the early part of the millennium. Some of them have been going for 5-6 years at least, and now we're going to finish in the next year. It's just not credible, actually. And I'm just wondering why they've been on this path for quite as long as they have been. Then there's a slide, I think it's slide 44, which is impossible to argue with. But in a sense, it's almost a cute statement. I can't think of a better word right now. It says, key elements of the revised project management model will include conducting feasibility studies. Seriously, we don't have as part of our standard operating procedures a feasibility study before we spend what looks like hundreds of millions of rand. And now we're going to bring in a feasibility study in the new management model. I mean, and that's to establish best business practices. We don't know, after nearly 25 years of democracy, what best business practices are. Establish the long-term sustainability of projects. We didn't know what the long-term sustainability of projects were before we embarked on all these things, started sometimes 10 or more years ago. Value for public money. Isn't everything that we do in this department, especially, but in most departments, governed by the fact that we must get value for money? I mean, I just find it incredible that a paragraph like that can be put in, as if these things are foreign concepts, and it's taken us the best part of 3 decades to find out that this is actually what we should be doing. I mean, surely you're not telling us that these principles were not entrenched in every one of these projects from day one. I'm really struggling to come to terms the way it's presented, as if it's a new thing and we've learnt important lessons. How can these lessons not have been learned right from inception? We have a corporate governance business model. We have best practices in business and in government that stretch back literally centuries. And are you saying we're going to actually bring it in because we've got all these stalled and failed projects? I mean, I just don't get that. Then there is a number of reconceptualizations that take place, or have to take place. Is it really possible that the initial work was done so badly, initial study or analysis was done so badly, that the thing has to be reconceptualized? I mean, surely before we committed all this money, a proper study was done, we had the concept right. I don't understand. I mean, what I'm looking at here is a list of projects where it would appear that management oversight was almost absent in its totality. I mean, to say something has to be reconceptualized means, in common English, you got it wrong right from the beginning. The concept was wrong, and we have to think about it in a different way. I'd like some more feedback on how it's possible that so many of these projects have to be reconceptualized. I mean, one would be too many, but there's more than one. And then, finally, projects not succeeding, or not, they will not be proceeded with. How can we commit to something, spend millions of rands, and then just calmly say to the committee, well, we're not going to proceed with that? Was there no proper planning in the beginning to establish that this thing was in fact a viable, sustainable, properly conceptualized, feasible project that would be seen through? I mean, the biggest belief. The last question I have is, and I've raised this for 15 years in Parliament, because when Minister Sankey Mahanyele, I think her name was, she had a double barrel surname, when she was Minister of Housing, she piloted through something called the NHBRC, right, which is an Act of Parliament now, National Home Builders Regulation Council, where you pay a big percentage in those days, 1.3% of the project cost up front, and that provided insurance for any structural damage that might occur in the structure or building or house that was going up. And it was like a consumer warranty in effect against bad building practices. That still exists to this day. It's a huge organization. But banks, for example, were prohibited by the Act of making mortgage or development finance available to property developers and homeowners if the house was not registered with the NHBRC. And that's how they enforced compliance. Joe Slover actually piloted that through Parliament in the early days, in the first Parliament. Now, in this report that you've given us, there's more than one instance of buildings not being structurally sound. How can that happen? How can a building not be structurally sound? I can conceive of cases where people in the private sector try and skirt government regulation, try to cut corners, try to circumvent the rules in order to save money. I mean, that happens. But how does a government department defy its own regulations? They're all part of government. If a building is structurally sound, you should be able to approach the NHBRC, because there's a 5-year warranty on structural buildings, and you should be able to go to the NHBRC, and they will then approach the people who did the construction, get them to repair their damage at their cost. And if that company's gone out of business or has been liquidated or no longer exists, then there's a huge fund running into billions that will repair that cost for you or repair that building for you. That's why the fund exists. It's an insurance policy. So there shouldn't be any projects here where buildings are structurally unsound. With A, you should not have employed anyone that wasn't registered as a competent builder with the NHBRC. You should not have made any money available to anyone that didn't meet that standard. And this is not the first time I've raised in this committee 10 years ago, or somewhere around then, we had a similar thing, and now it's popping up again. I don't understand how government doesn't actually comply with government regulations. I really don't. So it's interesting to read about a building destroyed by fire and has to be demolished because it's now structurally unsound. I wasn't aware that cement and concrete and steel reinforcing were combustible materials. The foundation should be secure, the superstructure should be secure, maybe the roof has been destroyed, but can it actually be that a fire can destroy the foundations of a building? I don't understand. There's so much that cries out for further investigation in this report. So some of those answers could be given. I don't know if it's possible to give them all today, but there is too many things that really, really worry me, and I look at the hundreds of millions of rands you're now going to have to commit to finish this by the 31st of March next year, and yet some feasibility studies and reconceptualization still has to take place. It's the worry.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thank you for the presentation. Jefferson, my first question is on the GDEC. GDEC is an entity of National Treasury. I would like to know what the cost was involved, the cost involved for GDEC to do the study. And I would like them to show to me where this was budgeted for. Where and when? How long did the study took? And did they take to come with this result? And Chairperson, I'm just a little worried about stored projects. I know for me stored means where the building is or the white, what else is. The white elephant stands there. What now? What now? Didn't you, when you started these projects, did some risk analysis? And if this project, say project A is in municipality David Kraper, and you are stalling it, what now? How do you explain it to the municipality in which it is? Have you tried to get an alternative use for that stored project? Chairperson, my other question is, you have hired the service of an entity. And when you hire the service of an entity, PG, through the chairperson, you must give your views as tourism, your target as tourism to that entity. Because they should do a targeted, they should have a targeted approach to what they, whatever they are doing. And you know, Jefferson, when it comes to the Treasury, there's a very clean record. And Treasury in this country is very, very high rated. And I am sure that this entity did good work. Now, why did the department afterwards come and say they don't agree with the recommendation? Because I'm sure they paid GDEC as it is an entity and must sustain itself. They should have said what exactly is it that we want. Chairperson, I'm not going into these individual projects. Safe to say that I'm a little, also a little very, very disappointed in some of the projects. Now, you said when we come to the key recommendation, short-term alignments. Urgent, indicate the urgent need for the implementation of a revised project management model. Is this model already designed? You know, we must learn and steal from other departments when they do this project model. Is it designed? When will it be implemented? Now, I'm a little lost here, Chairperson. On slide 44, the name designed by client model. Whose client model? Is it a model that they hired from someone? What is it? Then, Chairperson, on the key recommendations, the recommended approach to achieve such participation include the deliberations with PPP partner units at National Treasury. You know, this concept of PPP is an old one. It's a very old one. And I'm a little disappointed when they say they're only engaging on it now. in some way, I don't know where it is, they say that they will lose experts, which slide it is, for some skills development, something like that. You know, one likes to get on the wagon of skills development, skills, but how can we, how will you make sure that there is a skills development? Then the very last one, slide 44. Thank you. Now, Chair, the very last last question on the last slide 49, the implementation time frame. Now, you know, I don't know when this was set up, when the time frames were set up. It could have been a year ago, it could have been last week or last month. But, you know, I want always to look at where we are today and where we will be in 3 months' time. So, the department is telling us there will be a detailed feasibility study, operational models, conceptualization, and alternative site studies. We sit with 90 days. A lot of them are public holidays. Is this, can this realize? Are these dates easy to you? The first two,
are they realistic? Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And let me thank the department for the presentation of this information, because we did visit some of these projects and we were also worried with the state in which we found them, some of them not really working. So I'm looking at slide number 13, where in which we have already spent 23 million. And after spending 23 million, the recommendation is that we should not continue with this type of a project. To me, we have wasted a lot of money on this particular project. Now, based on that, I wanted to check also, how is our organogram like? Is it possible to have some of this expertise within our own organogram? Is it possible? For example, people will be doing the feasibility studies going forward. People will be managing our projects, like project managers and so on, so that we have someone who will be taking care of the project from the start. Is it possible to have such, so that we avoid the situation that we found ourselves in? The other issue that I wanted to check is about the issue of paying the people who are constructing beforehand. I don't know where are we now? Because some of the projects that we visited, there was indication that those people were paid before and they could not even finish the projects and so on and so on. What type of a strategy are we going to use now going forward? The other issue that I just wanted to check is the one on the road. I didn't get it very clear. If I can get an explanation, that one on the infrastructure. You said you are not agreeing with GTEC, you want to finish off the road. Was it the road only? There's no project, our own tourism project, just the road only. And if you can have more clarity on that one. Yeah. I think those are the things that I wanted to check. And also just to say, if we can be able to have our own expertise so that from the onset we start our project properly. As we look at this one, so the ones that they are saying we should not continue with, if you add the amount of money that we have already used, it's honestly too much. But we think we have learned something here. We need to change and do things in a different way. Thank you.
Now, thanks, Chair. Mine is very few, Chair. Let me just firstly thank the report from the DG and the department. I'm thanking the report because some of the things that I'm mentioning here, as a committee, we've been to oversight and then we saw them. Yeah. And when it comes in the report, we all agree. And the recommendations from the GTEC and from the department, let's all agree that is a true reflection of what you have seen on the ground. But what I want to caution the department with is that it shouldn't be like ongoing problem. Let's go and make sure that through the recommendation, from what you have been recommended, you are going to work on it. But honestly, I must thank the report because sometimes when you need a report, it takes long to come, but at least we see the report and we are all going to work together and try to correct what you have witnessed and then through the report. Sir, Chair, I just want to stop there because the report is a true reflection of what you have seen, and let's hope that the department is going to work on it. But there are lessons learned on this one. I don't think it will happen again. Thank you very much.
I just have also just two questions in regards to the assessment report on the GTEC process. Now, DG, I don't know whether of these 32 projects, okay, it's 31, but the other one is implemented differently. And I would also just say maybe to date, but the Cape Agulhas one is an exceptional project that we've witnessed and seen for ourselves how good the project is implemented through SEMPAC. These projects, are they not too much to be completed in the period that you are envisaging to complete them? Because at times I think taking too much of the work would also lead to the very same problems that we are coming from. Because I'm now thinking, moving forward, because we are now trying to correct things that did not go correctly. Perhaps we should rework, or you should see how best you try to minimize the work that you are going to take. Because I foresee recurring problems. Because taking 30 projects at a go and thinking that we can complete them, we are bound to go back to, although it's not now stated, because there are those that were still in the planning stages and the recommendations are that if they are scrapped and we do not continue it. But I'm looking at a possibility where in each financial year you can just target, perhaps, I'm not saying it should be that, but I'm just giving an example. Let's say 5 projects, and you know that working on this project, you are going to invest so much money and complete them. But thinking we can do all these projects at a go, I foresee some more challenges. Secondly, what I do not see coming up sharply in the recommendations of GTEC is the issue of the public-private partnership. Because some of the projects, perhaps if there was a partner, a public partner, a person coming in and investing in the project, it would not be your own burden of financing the project. And I don't see a partner coming in and wanting their money to be wasted, per se. Because some of the projects, like an example, one, the one in Mpumalanga, where a project was completely hijacked. The project is complete. It's sort of accommodation, and somebody has come in, fixed the vandalized structures, and is now taking proceeds of rental or accommodation in the project. You know, perhaps that also tells you that if this was a public-private partnership, there was going to be value for money. Well, I'm not saying the project should have been implemented in that way. I'm saying what GTEC is not bringing up sharply is the feasibility of government collaborating with private partners to take the project forward and derive value for money. Perhaps in a project that would be costing government $5 million. If there was a partner coming in, the money would be half. I think it was just those two aspects. Because I remember we did mention the fact that perhaps some of the projects, they would have been a success if there was investment coming also from the private. And also the tourism bodies that were meeting with as we went on the oversight, we're also bringing in the suggestion that perhaps if these projects were initiated and had some aspect of investment coming in from other partners, it would not just be a fruitless expenditure as some of the projects are.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I think I'm going to allow the colleagues to come in first, and then I will take the aspects that they would have not covered. I'm going to start with that.
Honorable Chair, the short-term assignment, the cost that GTEC has contracted with us is 984,000, and for the long-term assignment, which includes the review of the program, the guidelines, the processes, and the tools, came to 4.6 million.
The
support for the GTEC assignment.
The cost center is the EPWP goods and services component. So when they give us the money, they allow us to have money that would allow us also to be able to do work.
I'm going to try to answer some of these questions. So I think that there was a question that was related to why are so many of these projects requiring reconceptualization. I just put the slide back up which says how many projects were at what stage. So there were essentially 14 projects at planning and 2 at pre-feasibility. The recommendations around reconceptualization actually relate in the main to these projects. That's 16 projects in total. The stalled projects were 10 of them, and then requests for additional funding were 5. So stalled means that they were in construction and that there were some challenges that needed to be dealt with. And then, of course, the request for additional funding is where construction had happened and there was additional scope of work or changes in scope of work that needed to be funded. So that in total is basically 15. I think that also where the recommendations relate to alternate site use for some of the facilities that have been developed does in fact relate to the passage of time, Honourable Member Krumbok and Honourable Member Adams. Because as they were initially conceptualized, you're quite right, some of them are quite old, they're not required necessarily for the same purpose at this point in time. So that's really what relates to alternate site use for the facility. So it's not that the facilities will themselves go to waste. They will actually be utilized by those communities for a different purpose than they were initially intended. So an example of that, for example, is if we build a visitor information center and it actually doesn't require a visitor information center, some of those properties are in fact used for community meetings, projects, and spaces for young people to work in. So it isn't a case of those facilities then just lying there and not in fact being utilized. The second issue, which is related to sites that are stalled and that essentially have been constructed, there are 2 things that we do with those properties. The one thing is that we actually guard the facilities so that we ensure that what we have put in as an investment is in fact safeguarded. The second thing that we do on those properties is to ensure that there's proper cleaning services and maintenance of the properties in order for us to be able to complete it. So we don't actually just leave those properties abandoned without actually providing those 2 sets of services to them. With regards to buildings not being structurally sound, I think in the report I went through it again, there is in fact the only building that was found to be not structurally sound and needed to be demolished was Tenorhead. I trust the report from the structural engineer that says that the fire has in fact damaged that building to an extent that it is not structurally sound. And that report is coming from a qualified structural engineer who is recommending that on the basis of the fire damage, that building needs to be demolished. There, I think, were there may have been 2 others where we might have done structural assessments related to the property. The one is Frederfort Dome, where structural assessments have been done, and those actually relate to the geotechnical space that particular thing project finds itself in. So this was really related to movement in the building following construction, for us to get an assessment of whether that movement in the building was within the required allowances from a structural perspective, and whether there was anything that we needed to be worried about. Frederfort Dome is, of course, in that meteorite site. So there is, and this happens with any building. It's not just Frederfort Dome. Any building, after some time that it's been constructed, there's settling of the foundations. Sometimes that results in cracks in the building. Most of these are not actually issues around the structural soundness of the building. But I think that Frederfort Dome is the other one where we looked at the structural soundness of the building. I stand to be corrected if there are others that are in there that I haven't really gone through in detail. I think Lerato's covered the issues around the cost for the GTEC building and for the work that we're currently doing, Honourable Member Adams. And I think that your question relates to why do we disagree with the findings that GTEC has made. Perhaps the problem was in my explanation. There are only 8 projects where we disagree with the findings. Our disagreement with the findings, for example, relate to projects where there's already been developments on the ground and the recommendations have in fact been overtaken by events. The road, which is an example of where we disagree with the findings, that with that project it was only the construction of the road. And essentially that road leads to the Wet Sea Caves, which as I said is a spiritual site. It's 1.8 kilometers of road that was initially planned to be completed. 1.1 kilometers of road has been completed. There's in fact 700 meters that needs to be finished, and that was why we disagreed with the finding. We'd like to just finish the 700 meters that actually lead to that specific site. The implementation timeframes, I think the DG spoke to them. They are very stretched targets for us. But we are also very consciously aware that these projects have existed now for a long time. And we would like to complete them and to hand them over to the owning entities and not actually create any further delays in them. So I think that our ambitious timelines are really motivated by our desire to see completion of these projects so that we can actually hand them over, take them off our books, and start investing in projects that take into account the new model and the new way of operating in many ways. Honourable Member Adams, with regards to the model itself, design by client is not actually a model, it's more a philosophy of having your professional services team work with the client. So in some instances you have them sitting opposite the client, but what we're saying is that we are going to have the architects, the quantity surveyors, the engineers working on the client team, which is our team, and they will then manage the contractor. And our model hasn't actually been implemented in that way to date, but that is the model that we're going towards. With regards to the project management modeling and the work that GTEC is doing, as well as the standard for infrastructure delivery procurement and management, we are not inventing the wheel on any of those things. Those things are already tried and tested ways of project managing, and a SIPTEM, which is the infrastructure standard, is specifically related to managing construction and infrastructure within the public sector. So we are, in fact, using those tried and tested methods. We are using the templates. It's part of the reason that we brought GTEC on board. We are just customizing them for our context and our environment, because you will appreciate that those templates are used for mega projects that cost billions of rands, like the port infrastructure Transnet will invest in. Our projects are on a different scale, but nonetheless, those are still the actual methods that we will use. Okay, I'm going to stop. I think that there are some things I haven't necessarily answered, but...
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We, at this stage, we are not yet at a point where we can confirm if indeed there was progress expected in the strictest sense of the contract itself. The reason for that is because where we are saying, for instance, that we will not be proceeding, the buildings are actually going for what Shamila was calling alternatives. So at that point, it would still not necessarily be. In the case, I mean, we are still also grappling with the issue of, in the case where something is fire damaged and a demolition is recommended, that fruitless. And so that those are the kinds of things. So
we are preoccupied with that in terms of the actual classification of these discussions that our CFO also has with the accountant general in terms of at what point. So if it was something like Project X do not continue, there is no external damage that is beyond our control, and we are able then to say this thing is not useful, demolish this thing, that's where we would have been talking about fruitless, and we would have actually got into that particular stage. But at this stage, not necessarily. The second issue, the PPP, we really want to go that route. The challenge with it, it always reminds me of the willing seller, willing buyer. Because you got to have a private sector partner who is willing to share the risk. And in most instances, the private sector partners that we get, they come on board very excited, and then they start dictating the terms. Often those terms basically means we are going to be operating this thing, but you are going to be funding the operation. And it means there's no partnership basically. You are basically hiring someone to actually go and administer a property on behalf of that particular community. So those are the real most critical challenges. This is some of the lessons that we have learned. To say if you can have somebody to commit up front and have all the details, contractual issues sorted up front, that would actually then be able to get elsewhere. There are PPPs, honorable members, out there that are very long-term in nature, very, very long-term in nature, that unfortunately don't necessarily have the sense of benefits that one would have actually expected. And that's an area, even the team, our team that deals with broad-based black economic empowerment, they are looking at that particular space in terms of how best can we actually get more value from even concessions, not just this one, even concessions. So we are really pursuing this model. We have seen in some instances you would have someone who comes on board, runs it well, and generates sufficient revenue. What we are now saying is, in the same process, we need to look much deeper whether they are also making sure that maintenance is provided for. Because what would happen is that you go through the whole process. They make money. Everything works well. They pay the workers. They pay dividends in one way or another. And then 10 years down the line, they come back and they say, we need some recapitalization. That property does not even belong to us at that particular stage, and we are not able to actually do that recapitalization. So we are grappling with those concepts. What you have seen, Honorable Chair, at the Cape Agala, I really want to say that in the same way that we actually realized we needed to put a real stop on the project, part of it was if somebody comes and perpetually asks for more money, there's a threshold that as an accounting officer I can authorize, beyond which I can't. Only National Treasury can. Now, we needed to get a better understanding of what are the real problems that have led to that, and this is why we went for the forensic. And out of that, then we are coming back to actually rectify the things that we've actually seen through that particular process. So I do believe that when you look at a project like Cape Agala, we learned. And that's why we're implementing in that particular manner. And that's why we're working a lot more now with some of these government entities where there's better potential and then benefits would come through concessions. And that seems to be working for us. And it's not only the Agalas one. I mean, I want to give an example of the Robben Island project. We did that in time. We did that in, within court. So there are lessons, and part of what we did there was to get technical advisory capacity from day one. So when the implementers were squeezing us more, the technical people knew precisely that this is what they are trying to get you to do and don't do it. And that is what we have now brought into our ways of implementing this particular project. There are I think with the NHBRC, and I stand to be corrected, the NHBRC strictly works with residential property. We have had this discussion internally about insurance. It's a very difficult discussion because we actually don't insure property. We don't insure properties as government. The reason for that is because you could actually wipe out the entire budget paying broker. You will have to insure every single thing that's in the building. Now, let me give you an example. If you've got a department like Water Affairs, as an example, which has got in excess of 15 to 20,000 people, and in that particular building you've got tables, chairs, computers, this, and you will wipe out the budget really trying to make sure that everything is insured. So those are, and it's a question of do you take the risk? You take the risk in the end. What we do, however, which is more important in terms of the recourse, is that where there are issues structurally, the bodies that register these people are the ones that are able to deal with it. So you are able to go and report to the engineering council and so on and so forth. So these people can lose their licenses and so on. In some other instances where you've got implementers that have taken us for a ride, for lack of a better expression, we are able to blacklist. We blacklisted one implementer for a period of 10 years. There's a case in court, which is going to be going to court, so I'm not going to put the name on record. But for 10 years, Treasury has blacklisted this person in personal capacity, not just the company. The company is blacklisted, but the individual is blacklisted in personal capacity, starting from February 2018 until 2028. So. We do consider making sure that there is consequences for wrongdoings and so on. I need to say this, but I will also put a context to it. This will not necessarily be the end to problems with project management and implementation. But we are better equipped to manage the projects better. Simple example. You have an inverted commas business association. It happens everywhere in the country. Where the minute they know that somebody has got a particular tender, they insist that that person should actually source supplies from them. Whether it's a price issue and so on, they don't want to hear that. They want this person to actually source from them. Or at least be able to source from a group of people that are within that particular community. And it goes to a point where if you need this chair and you know that you're not going to find it there, they will buy it for you and then you must buy it from them. In essence, you're buying your license to be able to implement the project that you've got in the government. I'm putting this on the table because there are problems that will be beyond this department, far beyond. And those problems are not going to disappear tomorrow. We will need to work together where we find those things and we need intervention of Parliament and so on, or of a different department, will raise those issues. But the point I'm trying to make is that those will be some of the things that could make projects come to a complete standstill. and it would then require much broader facilitation. The success of all these projects is all about development facilitation. We will need to be in those communities, explaining what needs to happen, making sure that localization is also taking place during that particular process, and the local communities are empowered. They are not easy things. They are honestly not easy things. We also, though, take comfort, what Shamila was explaining, Chairperson, about this ambitiousness of the targeting. We're talking about completion of projects that are already there. So an example would be a project that alternative use is going to be considered with a building completed according to the standards that were there, according to the original contract. So that's something that we will definitely try and pursue. They are very, very ambitious targets, I must say. Whether we are going to be able to get them right within that particular time, that's what we hope for. We do have some capacity in-house to assist with some very basic feasibility issues and so on. What we learned through the process, they've been attending some very good courses from people that have developed this standard that Treasurer wants all of us to use. I didn't attend, but they were educating me on this thing. But what we are picking up is that we will need to have amongst us people that are able to understand what we need and explain it better. So we don't necessarily need an engineer in-house, but they must be able to understand one another with the engineers. So that's the kind of technical training that they have now. All of these people that are here, they can at least now speak intelligently about some of these things. Sometimes when I listen to them, I think they probably should have considered going through that particular route altogether. But having said that, we will still need external capacity, particularly given that at the moment, the biggest challenge that has been raised by government from a fiscal point of view has been the wage bill. So it will be impossible for us to get any additional funding, let me put it like that, any additional funding to reinforce the internal structure. But if we are asking for money to get advisory capacity for a year or two, it doesn't come with pension contributions, it doesn't come with, so there's a whole host of savings that actually come with it. And that's what we believe we would be able to use for the remainder of this project that we need to complete. The payment issue. Lerato, I had thought you were going to talk to me, but it's fine, I'm going to talk to you. Conceptually, the EPWP targets emerging enterprises. It targets emerging enterprises. And a special provision was made that these enterprises, because of the nature of relationship, it's almost like an agent-principal relationship as opposed to pure service provider relationship. So what they do, they do work on our behalf, and we have got to then keep an eye on what they are doing on the ground. And EPWP says you should then provide them with money to be able to do these things that they are supposed to do, as opposed to them using their own money, which actually they don't have, using their own money and then come back and invoice you for what they have used. And part of it is that you are not using normal business principles. You are building this using EPWP, and you've got to look at issues of creating
a certain number of full-time equivalent jobs and so on and so forth. So the kind of labor that you've got there is not the same kind of labor that you would have had if you were building your own house. And which is why, even when you're building your own house, what you would do, you would go to the bank would guarantee that yes, you've got this money in there. They would then want to know who's the person who's actually building for you. And that person would have access, unless if the person has got like real good money. And the surety then becomes the property that is on site. Now in this instance, we're clearing the bush, you are going to be using manual labor. There's no person, business person, who's going to enter that system with their own money. And this is why they allow us to say, you have to actually advance some of this money. We went through that and we even had to get an opinion when we were testing whether, because it actually got to a point where we had one implementer, not of infrastructure, of what is it? Of skills. We advertised the tender. He comes on board through the whole process. After he has been appointed, we go through thorough negotiations for the contract. We both sign the contract. Once we sign the contract, we need to provide the first tranche, which will deal with all these things, uniforms and what and so on, study materials, all those kinds of things. 3-4 days after that, he writes back to us and he says, I want out of the contract. We write back to him, we say, we want you to put the money into the following account. He disappears, he does not respond to our letter. We walk across, there's a police station near the door. We open the cases. We get the hawks on those cases. We get the NPA to assist in terms of the prosecution-driven investigations and so on. And we went further to ask that these people must also then make sure from Treasury side that this person is actually blacklisted. And all other instruments must then start to kick in. So this is the point I'm trying to make, that you will find bad, rotten apples in the process. And we have nothing to do with them, but they are there. So we have to deal with them in a different way. And then on the other side, you will find some very good people that have actually developed, VersiSook is developed through the same methodology. It's a beautiful project. So there are elements within the society that also contribute to this. You some of them you will not even be able to see this. This is a person who implemented a previous project with us and implemented it well. He comes back, he does this, and he disappears. So you look at that and you ask yourself, then what do you do? Fortunately, he's blacklisted in his own personal capacity. And we are going further. Some of these people are doing this are medical doctors. We just have to ask ourselves what is happening to the patient. If they can actually do this on something this scale. So these are the kinds of things that we will be reporting all these matters even to the Health Professional Council. Because for me, that's an ethics issue. So those cleanup issues, we'll deal with that. That's a separate matter. But the issue for us now is how do we get this project to be completed in expedited manner and also making sure that they fulfill some of the obligations that originally we had actually thought this is what we wanted to do. We could go on and on all of the chapters, but I do think that by and large we have covered some of the questions.
I appreciate the answers, Chair, but there are very few, and we didn't get to the number of this thing. So Shamila, I understand the difference between a settlement crack and a structural crack. I've been in the building industry for 25 years, okay? And you're not wrong, there is settlement to building, and it can go on typically 10, 15 years. I'm not talking about settlement cracks, I'm talking about structural cracks, which if you had a properly designed house, or building or structure, there would have been soil tests, there would have been certificates that would have been submitted by an engineer to the NHBRC, and no foundations would have been allowed to have been poured or slab been poured or foundations built until such time as they'd agreed to the structural design. So it worries me that I now hear from the TG that in fact you don't have NHBRC oversight on your site, which is not what the Minister told me of housing. So I'm going to be asking questions about that, because it seems incredible that everybody else has to pay the 1.3%, but government doesn't. So why is it that people are saying government-built installations do not have the security that people living in a residential structure have? So it's not just a developer that must be registered with the NHBRC, but builders themselves have to be registered in order for them to charge the homeowner. Sometimes that's included in the price of the building, and sometimes it is asked to be paid up front, mainly because of that issue. Okay. So what I think I'm hearing from you, DG, is that you don't use people that are, or you don't necessarily use people that are registered with the NHBRC. And then I can understand why you can't get insurance. So what you're talking about in the, I thought you said that you don't insure. That's what you said. So can you maybe just clarify that through you, Chair? What don't you insure, do you insure? In terms of government structure, like this taxpayers' money.
What about Chapter? The National Home Builders
Registration Council.
Registration Council. The insurance associated with it is for home building.
I understand that.
We are not, and I'm saying this with humility, we are not building homes. So that's why we don't qualify. So that's really the distinction. So the other one, this is why I said, because the word residential may mislead in that context. So we wouldn't be able to qualify to be part of the scheme. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
Okay, then I haven't misunderstood you. So what I understood you say is that you don't insure. So if you talk, there's two different things. There's household insurance, which you pay every single year through an insurance broker. And then there's the NHBRC one-off 1.3%, and that's now become a sliding scale. People who are proven that they are good builders over the years qualify for a lower rate. That also happens. I couldn't see why affordability was an issue if it's only a one-off payment once. In the beginning. But anyway, we'll get to
the issue is not being, we don't qualify to participate in the scheme. That's the point I'm trying to make. So you would say, but you will not play, if I could put it like that. Because if you say we're taking a lodge and you're going to put it into the Home Builders Association, Home Builders Insurance Scheme, you are not going to be able to get something out of it in the event that something then does happen. But general principle, Honorable Chairperson, and Honorable Kronborg through Honorable Chairperson, the general principle is that we properties, government, we are not able to insure all these things that we've got. And if you were to get some sort of actual work done, you will be able to then see that the cost of insurance versus the cost, the risk just taken and absorbed, it actually makes sense. It's a lot of money that would actually be going into just insuring all these things. So that's really the reason, the main reason is that we will not. So the person, if they've done something wrong, we have got to then go after that person as an individual or as the company, as opposed to actually recovering it through the insurance process. And unfortunately, that's the predicament we're taking.
Okay, I would allow you to just have one more bite and then we need to proceed.
But
yeah, because there are also other honorable who also want to have follow-up.
Yeah.
That's
I only have one bus, but now I have two interventions.
Okay. Okay, have your bus.
Okay, right. So, what I don't understand, DG, is the point about the cost, because you've gone at length to explain to us how people take the money, they don't pay it back when they're supposed to, when the contract fails, you lay a charge, you bring in the hawks, etc., etc., etc. And I don't understand, as a taxpayer myself, and I know we're all taxpayers in this room, how that is cheaper than paying 1.3% once. I don't buy the argument about affordability. What you're saying to me is you don't qualify to participate in the scheme. Now, if that is so, that's a lacuna in the legislation. Because if you're building a tourist thing including chalets, and one of these things does include chalets, or at least one of them that I've looked in the page I'm on, then that's residential. You're staying in a place overnight or for a period of time in a campsite, whatever it is, and it shouldn't be that those buildings are not required to be built at the same standards as everybody else, which is why you have to write an exam in order to become an NHB RC accredited builder. So that's not your problem, I understand that, but I will find out why there is a distinction. My question was going to be this. I put it to you earlier that there is a problem with these projects taking so long, and I take Shamila's argument that if something takes too long, a passage of time elapses, and then a reconceptualization is necessary. And in fact, it then also becomes a feasibility issue, because if you reconceptualize something, you have to work out if it's feasible. But, you see, what you haven't answered is why it's taken so long and what has gone wrong. Because if you look at the slides you've given us, there's 26 projects here that have had an inception or start date identified. Of those 26 projects, 15, which is nearly 60%, started in 2010 or further back. So there's three that in fact started between 2000 and 2005. That's what your presentation tells us. So there's a long, long time, on average 10 years, for those projects. 60% of these things are older than 8 years, probably around about 10, 11, 12 years old. And how can it be that a project can go on for so long that it stalls or it needs additional money to finish and has to be reconceptualized and a feasibility study has to be done, and then sometimes it doesn't even get completed because you take the decision no more money should be thrown at it? I hope one of you is listening to me, because we're having sidebars here. I'll wait for you to finish and then I'll carry on, okay? So my point is, what has gone wrong? That's a question I actually asked. Now, Shamila said we have had challenges, which is a word that can be used to hide almost anything. What were these so-called challenges? Why has it taken, in the case of 15 out of 26 projects that you've reported on, at least 8 years and probably greater than 10 years average, to get to a point where we're still not finished? That's the part I don't understand. And what I want to ask you is, do you think this has been a success? Because if I had a 60% rate of projects that took longer than 8 years to finish, such that they required more money, reconceptualization, and a new feasibility study done, I would say that's a failure. And I would say that the taxpayers' money has been squandered because it wasn't finished soon enough, and now we're incurring massive additional costs, sometimes not even using the project or completing the project for the original purpose for which it was envisaged. And that's what I wanted to ask, and I don't want to hear that you had challenges. What I want to find out is what actually went wrong, because this situation is not a good story to tell. That was my question that I asked in the beginning, and I, with respect, have not had an answer to that. Tell us what went wrong.
Okay,
thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The issue I wanted to ask, my colleague has already touched on it. I was going to say, Honorable Chair, going forward, as we check on this, especially those which are saying there should be some reconceptualization on them, and some of them being cancelled, it's because they dragged too long. Some of them 9 years and above. and somehow they were also taken up by events in the process. And at the same time, if a project takes such a long time, it will also work out to be very expensive than what you conceptualized at the beginning. So going forward, let's make sure that our time frames are reasonable, and we try also to implement our projects within that time frame that we had, so that we don't end up having this type of a situation where we have to change the initial plan for that particular project because now something else has happened. We have been taking a long time on it. That is what I just wanted to say. I think most of them, they took such a long time that maybe even the very same people I have in here were not even there by the time they started. Thank you.
Honorable members, perhaps what would have assisted us in this committee today while we're getting the presentation, perhaps if we went to our archive, secretary, to give us the report which the department once came to present to us. Because that presentation has a status on all the projects and where there is any forensic investigation, where there has been any issues where people have been taken to task. That report on its own, perhaps coupled with this, would have assisted today. But all is not lost. We can still get that presentation emailed to us as members, so that while we look at this, we can go back to that presentation on the status of all the projects. Because at one stage we wanted to get to the status of all the projects, why they have stopped, why they are at the stage where they are, and that report on its own has extensive information on also the way forward. But I would hand over to you, DG, to give a response to the two questions.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We have a varied reasons for the stalling of this project, which indeed we did explain the last time we were here. Some of them related to the conduct of the implementers, who are the business people that we actually have there. And that's why when we gave that report, we actually were going through specific cases, because these were detailed forensic reports that we had to commission on the basis of us not being satisfied with what we see. So there was no way that we would have continued, let me put it like that, we would have continued with the implementation. So you've got an active contract with a contractor. We have done things that are not supposed to be done according to this contract. Was asking for more money to be able to actually get additional things to be done. In that space, you stop the project. You get the investigators on site. They deal with the investigation. They bring back the report. The report says terminate. We terminate. The report says take them to the police. You then proceed with the criminal proceedings and so on. The report says recover. We've got a lot of recovery action that is actually taking place, as we speak, with the state attorney. So there's a whole host, and we reported on these things previously. So they are definitely different reasons per different projects. And at that point, when we had concluded those actions that we're talking about, we then moved on and said, okay, these actions now we have taken,
the ones that must go to court, they are waiting for the processes that they have to deal with on the other side and so on. The ones that we've got to recover, they're waiting for the processes that must be taken on the other side by the prosecution and so on. But the part that relates to what then do we do with this project? Because the contract, much as we have this formal contract with the implementer, our kind of social contract with that particular community is not waived. So we still have to go back to that environment and be able to ascertain what needs to be done. That is what GTEC was doing. GTEC has now given us the report, and the report says, here you can, here you shouldn't, here you should do this, and that's what we are reporting on today to say, out of that whole process, now we have reached at least a stage where we have got a very clear understanding of what needs to be done going forward. So that's really, but obviously I'm not doing justice to the fact that I think we had like a 3 to 4 hour full discussion with the committee on the actual report itself, where we went through every single project and the details there. Yes, I take the point of Chairperson that the whole insurance issue is a policy issue, and not necessarily it was a tourism issue, but it's a broader policy issue. As we go into the future, I suppose we'll investigate whether there are options that we can use besides NHBRC. But obviously we'll have to weigh the cost benefit. And if the cost, if the benefit outweighs the cost, then it's something definitely to be considered. When government is let down by unscrupulous practices of business people, it's really a bigger challenge. It's really a bigger challenge because we are empowering business by giving them opportunities. But when you look at the list of companies that we have had to take to the police, it's a challenge. A serious, serious challenge. And I think that is something that as lawmakers perhaps it's something to look into broadly, but it's really a much bigger challenge. It's not just facing us. We will do whatever we can, but there's limits to what we are capable of doing as well. The issue with the reconceptualization, yes, indeed, is a lesson. We may not necessarily have all the information about the original conceptual thinking around everything that was done. Like you said, some of the projects were way back. But the only thing that holds us against these projects up to this day is this social contract I was talking about. So a particular community which probably did not even get involved whatsoever in what do we call this, in the failure of the project, let me put it like that, and just happened to be having an implementer who did not do what was meant to be done according to whatever contract was there, need not necessarily suffer. So even in the cases where something may no longer continue, we will be going to those communities and explaining ourselves as to what exactly happened here, why are we not going to continue, and so on. Because in the end, it's about what the original purpose was, communicated to that community, what the expectation of that community is, and making sure that the community at least understands. I have had one specific project, it was 2 years ago, which was in a village called Chakuma, in Limpopo, in the Bembe district. No, it's in Makado district. Bembe district is Makado, local municipality. What this project was meant to be was a lodge, which was in a very beautiful site with a beautiful waterfall. The person who was meant to implement this did not do what was supposed to be done. And money also went into things that were not supposed to, it was not supposed to go into. Those are cases with the police. We reported about these cases the last time we were here. I had to go and face the chief and explain to him that unfortunately we will not be able to proceed. He had to convene his community for them to know that this thing is not going to continue. And we had to explain ourselves. The councillors were there, and so it was not an easy exercise. I didn't even take these colleagues with. I had to go personally. And we had to go through that whole process so that in the end, at least the community, it's absolutely clear what exactly happened. Now they are saying there are people that actually want to use that business, that site, and make their own investment. And these are business people. So when you look at that, you do realize, because the viability of the site is not an issue. But there are many cases. I'm trying to really bring the point home that there are many cases where we did what we could. When you see money, the statement comes out and it shows a transfer has gone to the chair, a transfer has gone to Honorable Krumbok, a transfer has gone to Ishmael, and this is being authorized by the implementer directly, and there is nothing that is actually being procured or being supplied and so on. I am quite confident, I must say, with the discussions that I've been having with the prosecution authority, that we are actually going to have some meaningful arrests. And I do hope that that would actually lead to convictions. So it's not the lack of trying. It's not bad intentions on the part. I've got a very solid team with ethics. But it is a question of we are not the only player in this game. The others must equally play the same way. So we will be keeping an eye on all our projects, and we'll be making sure that there is much more closer monitoring. We have reinforced our monitoring capacity. So we should be able to see better results. Of course, like I said earlier, EBWP methodology in terms of infrastructure is something we are also grappling with, because it is the essence of that methodology that takes more time to be able to conclude some of these projects. If we are using EDWP money only, we have to find ways of making sure that other things are solved through other funding. And EDWP just helps us with the labor in the main. Otherwise, we will not be able to finish this project timely. So that's what we have been trying to get into. But we will take some of the feedback that we've been given by the honorable members, and we will effect it. I want to also apologize that I was not necessarily interrupting Honorable Krumbok. The intention was just to provide clarity on what he wanted to speak to, so that at least he's got the total picture before. Thank you.
Thank you, DG, and your team. We will hold you to your time frame that you put yourself, because we yourself that put those time frames. As a committee, we will monitor and run progress based on those time frames. And let me take this opportunity to thank you for coming and briefing us on the progress on the GTEC process, on the project, and we are hoping for the best. Because we've witnessed ourselves some of the projects and how the community is eager to have those projects up and running, because some of them will benefit the community. Honorable members, we've got 7 minutes that we need to go through and adopt. I would allow you to leave us so that we continue with our housekeeping, and wish you all the best as you travel back to your place of work, and wish you all the best as you undertake to ensure that these projects are implemented.
Geht der Apfel? Oh, schön.
Was ist denn da hier an?
Can you look? Oh, that can be my answer there.
Okay, thanks, sir. We've got three sets of minutes here. One, the minutes of the 31st of January, where the committee was just basically dealing with the programming issues. It's just a straightforward minutes though. And then the second one are the minutes of the 28th of February, where we were dealing specifically with the entity second and third quarter report. Then members can see on page six and seven. That's where really the issues the members they raised to the entity, so that they can focus on those issues when we meet with them back again. And then the third set of minutes, Chair, is from last week, after our interaction with the SAT, when we were also engaging them on the second and third quarter reports. Members would see the issues that came out of those deliberations on page 5, 6, and